This is Dr. Richard Verreau, and I'm continuing my oral history interview for the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project with Mr. David Taylor. Today is May 4th, 2005, and it's approximately 8:34 a.m. Central Standard Time, and I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, in the interview room here on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Dave, you are again in Medina, Ohio. Mm-hmm. Let's pick up here where we left off. You just got back in the field, and you had been wounded. And when you came back, tell me what the reaction was of your men and how they, you know, could you sense anything from them? Like, they're really good. It's good to see you. Good to have the, you know, you back in versus having another leader.
Well, I was not out that long. I had been wounded and had the shrapnel picked out of my head and neck.
Right.
And went back to the battalion base camp. And then I was supposed to go back to the field that night, mm-hmm. but I missed the helicopter, the resupply helicopter. And as it so happened, that evening, the company was on the top of this hill because it was so rocky, they couldn't dig in. And the North Vietnamese popped some mortars on the hill, mm-hmm. I think about 8 mortar rounds. And a lot of them fell on along the one position of another platoon. Mm-hmm. And so, and I believe they had like 10 or 12 casualties from that. So when I arrived the next morning, the mood of the men was rather somber because they had taken a beating the night before.
Mm-hmm.
I remember down at the base of the hill, a distance of maybe 300, 400 meters, they had killed this individual who was walking along. We were in this so-called free fire zone, and it was a male, military age, and yet no one had bothered to go down to check out the body.
Hmm.
And so I thought that was strange, and so I told the company commander I was going to take a squad down there to check out the body, and which is what we did. And I took all of my new men that were new to the field, and I wanted them to have a reality check. And so we went down to the body, and it was a strange thing. This individual had no weapon on him. He was carrying a pair of military pants. He was wearing shorts and a shirt, but he had these North Vietnamese Army pants that he was carrying.
Mm-hmm.
By then, the sun had been baking on him for a while, so rigor mortis had set in, and he was pretty stiff. And my men were kind of like looking at him. This is the first dead body they've seen.
Right.
And I had each one of them go over and touch this dead enemy. And I wanted to get across a point. And I told them, I want you to look at this dead body real hard, because if you sleep at night when you're supposed to be on guard, or you lose concentration on what you're supposed to be doing, you're going to be looking just like this guy. So I don't know if it had much of an effect, but it seemed like it was something drew me to make that lesson when I had these new guys. And so we went back up on top of the hill, and the company moved out shortly after that.
What kind of reaction did they give you? Could you notice anything?
Yeah, they were kind of stunned, but I think they needed a reality check that war was for real. And I know the first time I was in the field, I didn't have that reality. And sometimes you just need to be shot at, or you need to see death just to get that reality and get your head on straight.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel any guilt at all for being gone that night when they were shelled?
Yes, I did, because I thought I needed to be with my men with that kind of thing. You need to, you don't want to be involved in that or experience that, but you need to be with your men and share that as a leader, and I wasn't there, and, you know, I felt bad because the dumbasses back at the battalion were supposed to tell me when the resupply helicopter came in, and I was never informed. So no one took that against me. I think they were even surprised to see me out in the field the next day after I got shrapnel in my head. So but I should have been there the night before, but I wasn't.
Dave, tell me about how does it feel as a commander, as a leader, to have men under your command, whether you're present there or not, wounded? What do you do as a leader?
Well, the first thing I do is I have to keep my mind on the mission. So if we're in the middle of a firefight or we're getting mortared and the enemy is close by, the leader has to keep concentration on, number one, trying to nail or kill as much of the enemy as you can. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, very close second is you need to take care of your men. You need to save lives.
Right.
And I guess if given the choice, if I had to leave some enemy get away because I had to take time to save the lives of my men, that actually takes precedence.
Okay.
But you try to balance the two. And so that's basically, there's two things, you know, accomplish the mission, however large or small that may be,
mm-hmm.
but then also take care of your men and make sure they live to get home. I made it a point never to get close to my men because I did not want to grieve unnecessarily in the middle of the heat of battle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was not their buddy. But we had a cordial relationship, and I think they respected me because I looked out for them.
Is that one of the keys to leadership, then, you think, in the field, is kind of keep your focus on the mission versus trying to get or allowing yourself to get very, very close to your men?
It was for me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing some other platoon leaders becoming more like a buddy for their men. And I don't think you can do that in war because mm-hmm. sometimes you have to make some hard decisions. And if you have developed a rapport as a buddy, sometimes those decisions are not made that should be made. And
right.
I've seen that with other junior leaders.
I was going to ask you, did you witness that yourself?
Yes, I did. I mean, when you become a buddy, then you lose your role as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mission suffers. And you just can't do that.
How do you figure out how much distance to keep? Is that something that is it personality dependent, or is that something that is just most people, if I went out there, I could figure that out, or is that simply your style of leadership?
I think it should be not my style, but it should be the style mm-hmm. of leadership, and you don't have to be someone's buddy to be liked and respected.
Mm-hmm.
What a soldier wants out of their leaders is to know, number one, they care for them, and number two, that the leader is technically and tactically proficient,
mm-hmm.
that you know what the hell you are doing.
Right.
And you're not going to put them at unnecessary risk. War has risk, and I think soldiers accept that. But they want a leader who is proficient, that's not going to put them at unnecessary risk, and that will keep them informed as to why they're doing what they are doing. You know, how far do you have to march in the hot 95-degree weather with a 60-pound rucksack, why you are going where you are going, what you are trying to accomplish. And if you keep the men informed and they know that you are looking out after them, that's all they require.
Right. When you said so-called free fire zone, why did you term it like that?
Well, the free fire zones, and I think we mentioned this before, sometimes were a misnomer. Basically, a free fire zone was at the set up where there was knowledge that there were no friendly forces in the area, whether friendly military or friendly civilians, and that if you were fired upon, you did not have to go through a lot of coordination in order to get permission to fire artillery or gunships and that kind of thing.
Right.
It still does not preclude the fact that you could see civilians in the area. Now, they may be supporting the enemy
mm-hmm.
versus the government, but you don't fire on unarmed civilians. But it is simply a methodology to let people in the rear that can offer you fire support, either helicopters or artillery, that you're in a free fire zone, so it requires less clearance to give you support.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to continue chronologically with where you went after, you know, you came back in and you described that morning?
Yes, day. Shortly after that, we're talking about the late May time, 1969 time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after that, we came back to LZ Gator, our battalion base camp, and we were supposed to have a night or two off for some rest. And my company commander, we were just turning in all of our equipment, and my company commander came to me, and he said, well, the rest of the company are going to have the night off here. They can stay at Gator. But I just got a mission that I want you to lead. And essentially, it was a village that was just north of LZ Gator, about a mile north. That was a friendly village, and the Viet Cong had threatened to attack it. And they only had about four or five local popular force soldiers in the village, and these people were poorly armed. And so the mission was for me to take my platoon into the village as a show of force.
Mm-hmm.
My men, needless to say, were not happy. But I told them to saddle up and get their gear together and get a basic load of ammunition, grenades, that kind of thing, that we were going to walk off the hill, that LZ Gator, that night.
Mm-hmm.
Once it got dark.
Mm-hmm.
So they grumbled, but we did it. And here again is, if I were their buddy, they may have felt that they had a chance to talk me out of it, not understanding that shit flows downhill.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that those are orders, and then we have to follow them. But I didn't have that problem because I was their leader, not their buddy.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, we're getting ready to walk off the perimeter at night. And I did a double check with some of the men, a spot check, and some of them had no ammunition. And I found that incredible, but the GI sometimes wants to be lazy, and I think maybe they thought they were going to get off of there with a lighter load, and that since it was a local mission, they would get by without carrying much ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I had an ass-chewing and sent the squad leader back to get ammunition for them. They had a minimal amount, and so we plussed them up. It was just incredible how sometimes GIs can get lazy.
Yeah.
We walked off the fire base that night in the dark. We went, maybe a quarter of a mile, and then we sat down for the night. And then the next day, we entered the village. And even though my men were upset that we had to do that after coming back from the field, as it turned out, it was a great duty. We stayed there for a week in this village. It was very idyllic, lots of shade trees. There was a little river that passed through it, and we had the best time. It was a nice R&R. The place was never attacked. The people took care of us. We gave them our sea rations that we didn't like, the ham and limas and the other things.
Mm-hmm.
And they mixed it in with hot rice with herbs and spices. And every day would bring this big bowl of rice with sea rations in it. It was absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And we managed to get some beer in there. So it was a nice R&R for a week.
Mm-hmm.
With nobody messing with us. While the rest of the company was up on LZ Gator, you know, probably doing a lot of duties such as filling in sandbags and that kind of thing.
Right. How typical was that experience? Just, you know, coming in and seeing a village, being part of that civilian Vietnamese life in a positive way like that.
It was a good opportunity for me to get a sense for how the Vietnamese lived.
Mm-hmm.
They appreciated us being there. The people, they had a little worshiping temple.
Mm-hmm.
Buddhist worshiping temple, and each night they would tell me, you know, that you will hear noise coming from the temple, and that's just them praying, and don't be alarmed. I even had my men escort some of the young women to the temple since it was at dark and they would feel more safe. And I placed my headquarters, platoon headquarters, on the western side of the village, which was facing the jungle area. All the north, the south, and the eastern side of the village was all open rice paddy.
Right.
And so I figured if we would get attacked, it would come from the jungle area. So that's where I placed most of my men. And I do remember at night walking along the edge of the village by the rice paddy, and they would have these bamboo platforms set out at different sections where some of the men of the village would sit on the platform, taking turns all night looking out over the rice paddies as an early warning system.
Mm-hmm.
If they saw someone coming, they would ring a gong, and then that way I and the popular force soldiers could go in that direction to see who was approaching the village.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting there with these men at night, and I could not speak no Vietnamese, but I would share with them American cigarettes, and they would share with me their hot tea and rice bread. And it was just an experience that I'll never forget. And parenthetically, a long time later, in 1997, when I made my first trip back to Vietnam, I went into the same village, and I actually found the little hooch where I stayed at. It was still there.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
It was just a very special occasion for me.
I can't even imagine that. That is
yeah.
Incredible. I can only imagine what you might have felt there.
It was actually a cement dwelling, a small dwelling, where the people during the war, they would use that to stack their bags of rice. And they said that it was empty at the time when I was there in the village with my men. And so they said, well, you can use this location. And it was on the western side of the village, so it was a good location. And there was a dirt, a dirt area in the front that was cleared up, kind of an open area that we could sit and eat and everything. So it was just ideal. And in 1997, I went back. That little cement building was still there. And I took pictures.
Wow.
When I went back in 2003, the cement building was gone. And in its place, someone had built a brick home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was glad that I was able to see it when I did in 97.
Were you able to talk to anyone there in 97 about who you were, what you, and why you were there, why you were coming back?
No, I... you know, I think a lot of the people that were there during the war had probably already passed on, and there were younger people there. And I felt like I was intruding on their village. They just kind of stared at me.
Mm-hmm.
The children had smiles. The older people, they just kind of stared a little bit, so I did not want to intrude too much.
Okay.
But they were very gracious, and I actually rode through the village on the back of a little motor scooter from a local kid that I
mm-hmm.
paid a few bucks to out on Highway 1 to be able to go into the village.
Mm-hmm.
And I just pointed the direction I wanted to go, and I saw the whole village that way, and then I left.
That's very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Dave, let me ask you a couple of general questions while we're here in the middle of your tour, before you're evacuated finally. Can you tell me or make some comments on the following topics about what you witnessed in Vietnam, either personally or things you heard about, and then perhaps comment on what it means to you today? The first topic is fear. Could you tell me your thoughts on that? What did you feel then, personally, for you, and then in your men, and possibly what you heard?
The fear came in degrees, and it depended on the mission that you were assigned to or the area you would be going into would raise or lower the fear level.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain areas over there that... there was less fear primarily because there were fewer mines. And so, for example, when we operated in the rocket pocket, There were no known North Vietnamese regulars in there, just a few scattered Viet Cong who tried to fire rockets into the Chu Lai division base. And so while no place is secure from being attacked or ambushed, the rocket pocket for me and my men had less fear than working south of LZ Gator by the Trabong River, where there were NVA elements around. You knew there if you were going to meet up with them, it was going to be a tough fight. Mm-hmm. Or the highest fear level was working east of Highway 1 on the Batangan Peninsula, which ran from Quang Nai City and the Pinkville My Lai area, mm-hmm. all the way north up to Chu Lai. That area was heavily laden with mines. And whenever we had to go out there, the fear level went up quite a bit because it was just, we lost so many injuries and if not killed in action, certainly lost arms and legs from all of the mines out there.
Dave, how did you personally deal with fear? I mean, do you remember you being scared?
I was scared. I try not to show it. If they don't have confidence in you, the leader, then confidence pretty well falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I was afraid, and I channeled that two ways. I mean, I channeled that in terms of being very concentrated on not making mistakes, not walking on trails, not walking through natural hedgerow openings, cutting our own way. Those kinds of things, not trying to set patterns of movement. So I became very demanding of my men, and that kind of is how I treated my own fear.
Mm-hmm.
When we were under attack or small arms fire or that kind of thing, then I channeled my fear into anger. Anger for the enemy. That was mm-hmm. that was the way I treated my fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became very angry that they would dare attack me and my men. And I've had men, you know, wounded and that kind of thing. So the way I covered my fear is I got very, very angry and aggressive towards the enemy in terms of calling in artillery fire, helicopter gunships, those kinds of things.
Right. Okay. What about bravery?
I think it, you know, it's said a lot, but it is so, so true that bravery exists every day just by being out there in the field,
mm-hmm.
particularly in a heavily mined area such as we had on the Batangan Peninsula. Every grunt showed bravery every day just by going out and walking, never knowing when one step or the other might hit a mine or a booby trap. That took a lot of bravery, a lot of guts. In terms of bravery that might earn an award, you just don't think of those things. You don't go out looking for those. I never did. I don't know of anybody that did. I think that the higher up you go in the command level, I hate to say this, but I think sometimes, not always, but sometimes your battalion commanders or maybe battalion staff officers who are back in the rear, they kind of have a tendency to look for bravery medals. But the grunt in the field, that's the last thing on their mind. But as often happens, just by being in the field and being a grunt and getting the mission accomplished, sometimes you have to do something above and beyond, and that's where the bravery medal comes. But you look at it and you say, well, wait a minute, why did I get a medal for that? I was just doing my job.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so true. When I was back at the hospital at Fort Dix, New Jersey, recovering from wounds,
mm-hmm.
I was notified that I was awarded a Silver Star, and I was very perplexed because it's like, why? I was just doing my job. I did not think it was anything brave.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think many times the bravery comes in the context of other people looking at what you did and saying, yeah, that requires a medal. You certainly don't look at that from your own personal view.
Okay. Did you ever question how you would react under fire before you got there? I mean, I guess it's a natural thing to do. How am I going to do it? How will I perform?
You question yourself, but you don't dwell on it, because if you dwell on it too much, then, you know, you start getting cautious, more cautious than you should be. But yes, it's always in the back of your mind. The way you deal with that is you just remember your training, mm-hmm. and you just react according to the way you were trained. And the more time you have in the field, the more you develop your own SOPs and your own way of modifying your training to be more effective,
right.
based on your experience. After a point in time, experience takes over from the training that you had.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about humor?
Oh, yeah. Humor is every day. Sometimes it's gallows humor. Sometimes it's just humor of people laughing at each other. Of course, rarely did we ever call each other by first name. Sometimes it was last name, and most times it was by nickname.
And you were LT.
I was LT.
Poor lieutenant.
Yeah, they just called me LT. And we had nicknames for a lot of the men that they gave to each other. Sometimes I would call them by their nickname or depending on the individual, because I didn't try to get too close to them. Sometimes I would just call them by their last name.
Can you tell me some of the nicknames you had, if you can remember them, for your men, or what you heard them calling each other?
Well, yeah, for example, nicknames come from either physical attributes of the men, mm-hmm. or something that happened. In the case of my point man, he was tall, redhead, and he had a Fu Manchu mustache. We called him Genghis.
Yeah, he's just inviting something like that, isn't
right,
he?
Right, because we thought he looked like Genghis Khan. He was very tall, muscular, had this big mustache that hung down with the red hair, and he looked like Genghis Khan, and then, so his name was Genghis.
Okay.
His shotgun, the guy that worked with him on the point who had a shotgun, we called him Woody. His name was Woodrow.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things. My squad leaders, though, I would probably, I did call them Sergeant Scherf or Sergeant Bakovich, that kind of thing. My platoon sergeant, who was a staff sergeant, I called him Sergeant Green.
Okay.
So the sergeants I called them not by nickname but by their rank.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's move on with what happened in the field.
Leave
the village.
Sure. Shortly after the week, at the end of the week that I was in the village, the battalion intelligence officer came to the village and told me that the village south of us, between us and LZ Gator, which was a very pro-Viet Cong village, that they were going to do a cordon and search. Now, at the time, my company commander was back on LZ Gator because when he was checking out a position by a quarry off of Highway 1, where some of our men were there at the top of the quarry to guard it, walking back down the trail to his Jeep, someone set off a command detonator of mine, killing his Jeep driver, and he had some shrapnel in his foot. Mm-hmm. And so he was not in the field for a while to let his foot get rested. The rest of the company was out in the rocket pocket, and they came back from that into my village. And so I took command of the company, and we were going to do a cordon and search of this village just south of us.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early morning hours, I was supposed to cover the east, the north, and the west of the village, and then another company would cover the south of the village, which was by LZ Gator. And so we moved out at night, early morning, I should say. And I had my men spread out. The The east and the north were all rice paddies, so I didn't put too many men out there. I took most of the company on the west, where it was more scrub brush and trees and that kind of thing. And I was very proud of the job I did. I think we had a very tight cordon, and I was west of the village, where I thought we would see some actions with people trying to flee the village. And we set up ambushes and that kind of thing. But I could see where I was at a high point overlooking the south of the village. And the strangest thing happened, all of the villagers, they could sense that they were being cordoned. All of the villagers ran out the south side of the village towards the LZ Gator and towards Highway 1. And the company that was supposed to close the cordon never showed up.
Really?
So I was pissed off as hell,
mm-hmm.
And so was the battalion intelligence officer later, because it wasn't done properly. So the Viet Cong that were inside the village got away.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I remember about that is here we are on the western side, and all the scrub brush. I had ambushes set out just in case someone would try to slip through. And while we are waiting for the intelligence people, the South Vietnamese and our American intelligence people to go into the village, I get a call that the assistant division commander wants to land near my location.
Mm-hmm.
And so I popped smoke, and he landed in his helicopter, and he walked over to me, and I showed him how I had my company cordoned around the village, and he was happy with that. And he said, well, I hope this is successful. There's some hardcore Viet Cong leaders in that village we want to get to. And, of course, by that point, I was thinking to myself, what's the point?
Right.
They already got out. And so as he's walking back to his helicopter, he turns to me and he says, oh, I didn't give away your position by landing here, did I? And this was a brigadier general, one star, and I says, oh, no, sir, not at all.
What do you say to that?
I mean, what are you going to say to a general?
Yeah.
It was like it was a screwed-up operation at that point. And so I thought that was kind of interesting how some higher-ranking officers kind of lose touch with the obvious.
Mm-hmm.
After that that day, we went back to LZ Gator. And a short time later, we were informed that we were on another mission, and this was to be a road clearing operation. The Trabong Road, which was from just south of the provincial town of Binh Son,
mm-hmm.
It's B-I-H-N, Son, S-O-N.
Mm-hmm.
The Trabong Road went from Highway 1 out west to the Trabong Mountains and the Trabong Special Forces Camp.
Okay.
And it was called the Cinnamon Road because back during the French colonial days, there was a cinnamon plantation out there in the mountains. And so the French trucks would go out there to get the cinnamon and haul it in. It was just a dirt road. And the engineer unit had been out at the Trabong Special Forces Camp to improve its defenses. And so the mission was to land on this road at various places with engineers attached to sweep the road for mines so the engineers could come out with their vehicles from the Trabong camp. And then also there's some South Vietnamese soldiers wanted to come to the camp from the east to reinforce the camp. So we were to clear this road of mines. Our company was given the mission, and each platoon reinforced with engineers was to land at a different section of the road and sweep the road going east of mines within a certain period of time so that the engineers could come through.
Mm-hmm.
The only intelligence I had for this mission was that there were some Viet Cong tax collectors in the area and that the road did have mines and we had to get rid of the mines.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, tax collectors, I never cared for tax people anyway, so that was nothing I couldn't handle.
Right.
So something told me the morning, this is the morning of the 3rd of June, 1969, Something told me that not to eat breakfast. I wasn't that hungry, and I just decided I was not going to eat breakfast. And so what that meant is I went in on this assault with a fairly empty stomach,
mm-hmm.
Which was to be good as things turn now.
Mm-hmm.
We air assaulted into our area of the road, no enemy fire. And so after the helicopters left, we were up and running with heading east to clear our road. Our section of the road had a lot of mines, and so it was kind of slow going. And every once in a while, we would get sniper fire.
Mm-hmm.
North of the road was the Trebong River. The south of the road was open area. It was just low scrub brush. For about 700 meters, and then there was a woodline, and then woods beyond that. And from that woodline, we were getting sniper fire. So that held us up. The company commander flew over in a helicopter and told me to, you know, try to speed things up. And this is where the local leadership comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we would get sniper fire, the men would go to ground. But the sniper fire was coming from a fairly far distance away, about 600 meters. And it was more of harassment than being accurate. So here I am being told by the company commander, keep things going, you're moving too slow. And so whenever we had sniper fire and we went to ground, in my judgment, the fire was too far away to be effective. You don't, as a leader, lay on the ground and tell everybody else to get up. You get up yourself. And so I would rise and I would walk to the front of the file, and everybody watched me, and I would not draw any sniper fire. And so then I would tell everybody to get up.
Okay, Dave, hold on. Tell me a couple of questions. How do you tell, and this might be something very obvious for you, but for people listening to this, how do you tell what's harassment sniper fire and actual sniper fire coming in at you to kill?
Well, for me, the harassment meant that it was too far away to be effective.
Okay.
And so I think they were just trying to slow our operation and maybe get us to leave and not sweep the road. I think that was probably the mission.
What do you just hear the gunshot and or do you actually hear the bullet? Or what? How do you determine that it's too far away to be effective?
We could hear the fire. It was what we call a crack and thud.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you can hear the rounds go off, but it and then it takes you a few seconds, and then you can hear maybe the bullet coming nearby. Not always. In this case, I could hear the rounds go off. But it takes a number of seconds for you to hear the sound after the AK-47 is fired.
Okay.
But I could judge it was coming from the wood line that was 600 or 700 meters away, which was not that accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I would get up first though and walk to show the other men I was not drawing fire. And then I would tell everybody get on their feet and tell the engineers to keep working.
What are you thinking as you're walking forward like that, going, okay, I'm going to check and see if they're accurate or not, or if it's safe or not?
I'm thinking, oh, shit.
Yeah, that's what I figured you were thinking.
But it was a reasonable risk.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's reasonable risk, and then there's imprudent risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taking a reasonable risk. I did not think they were going to hit me, and they did not. In fact, the sniper fire always stopped. So this happened a couple times. And then I heard a helicopter coming over. It was a light observation helicopter, a LOCH, as we used to say, LOOCH.
Yes.
And this pilot in the LOCH came onto my frequency, and he said, I hear you have had some problems with snipers. I'll be in the area for a little bit. Is there anything you want me to check out? And this was a what we called a light helicopter gunship team.
Mm-hmm.
It was just him and one helicopter gunship following him. And I was happy to see him because it was getting to be a pain in the ass with this sniping fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, yes, I am getting sniper fire from the wood line south of my position, about 700 meters. And he says, okay, I'll take a look. He started flying from the road over the scrub brushed area to the wood line, and he gets about halfway over this area of low-lying scrub brush, and he starts circling, and he says, oh, I see an NVA soldier. He just ran into a tunnel. Mm-hmm. I'll just drop smoke so you know where he's at. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, that's like 300 meters away, and I didn't even see him. And so then he goes on further south to the wood line, and I am listening to him on his frequency as we are walking on the road, and I could hear him say, oh, I see uniforms hanging on a clothesline. I'm going in to take a closer look. And as soon as he said that, I heard this big explosion, and I'm looking at him over the wood line, and I see this big rush of black smoke, and he was hit undoubtedly by a rocket propelled grenade or some sort of small arms. And I heard nothing more from him, but I heard all this dark smoke. The gunship that was following him was then on the radio saying, bird is down, bird is down, bird is down. Mm. And then my heart sank because I'm the one that sent him over there.
Right.
And so the gunship was flying around the area, shooting the area around where this loach had crashed. And my heart really sank because, you know, this guy is working for me. So I felt bad about that, plus the fact that there was enemy there that weren't supposed to be any enemy.
Right.
Shortly after that, the battalion commander landed on the dirt road with the company commander in his command and control helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And he came over to me, and he said, with a rather stern look on his face, I want you to take men in on my helicopter and go in and protect that crew until I can get more reinforcements. And I glanced at my company commander who was standing next to him, and the company commander had this look of remorse on his face. And it didn't dawn on me then what that was, and I found out 30 years later, which I'll relate in a minute.
Okay.
So the battalion commander tells you to do something, and so you do it. And I was my adrenaline was flowing because I was pissed off that the helicopter was shut down. So I selected a machine gunner and his assistant gunner, one of my squad leaders. And my radio operator and myself, and we started running towards the command and control helicopter. As we were going there, another squad leader by the name of Sergeant Bakovich, that's Bakovich, came up to me, and he said, you need some extra help. And I couldn't understand why someone would volunteer to go in on this, because we knew the enemy was there. The men that were getting on the helicopter had this worried look on their face, and I don't blame them, but that they did what they were told.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I looked at this sergeant thinking, why is he volunteering? But I said, yeah, get on the helicopter. And that was a decision that saved my life. So we get on the helicopter, and we start flying in the short distance.
Mm-hmm.
And I yelled to my men in the helicopter, as soon as we land, get behind some trees or brush or some cover, and I will check out the crew. I did not want everybody just wandering around. And so the helicopter gunship that was flying over the area got behind the command and control helicopter as we started descending into the site. The command and control pilot saw a ditch near where the loach had been shot down. And so at the last minute, he decided to make a left turn and go to let us out over the ditch, so we had half of a chance of getting into the ditch and finding some cover, which was a very good decision on his part. just as the helicopter pilot was starting to land, the gunship behind him said, left turn, left turn. So the command and control helicopter moved to the left just as it was landing over the ditch. And I was the first one that jumped out. And as I jumped out, the helicopter gunship behind me was firing his grenade miniguns, M79 miniguns. Mm-hmm. And so all of these explosions are these grenades are exploding all over the place just as I'm dropping out. Mm-hmm. And that's probably what saved me, because the enemy had to get their head down. The two squad leaders and the radio operator jumped out the right side helicopter following me. The machine gunner and the assistant gunner jumped out the left side. My people got into the ditch as I ran forward to the helicopter was shot down. Unknown to me at the time, the machine gunner and the assistant gunner that got out of the left side of the helicopter, the North Vietnamese shot them as they jumped out. They were cut them down. The two squad leaders and my radio operator managed to get into the ditch. So I ran to the helicopter that had been shot down. It was on its side, on its top, pretty much upside down. And I saw the pilot and the assistant, the crew chief, were pretty much burned up. They had exited the helicopter, so they were alive, but the North Vietnamese had shot them. Mm-hmm. And it was clear to me they were dead. Then to the left of them was another soldier, which was, I thought was odd, because they were only supposed to have two on a loach, the pilot and the crew chief. So I crawled to this individual, and he had been shot in the neck and in the stomach. I think they were using him for target practice. And in the meantime, I'm being fired at from the bush around me. Mm-hmm. And I'm firing at the same time I'm trying to check this guy out. I thought the third man was dead. And as I started to turn to leave, I saw his hands started moving. And I knew he was alive. And I think he was trying to signal to me that he was alive, but he was too afraid to move because he had been shot twice already. Mm-hmm. I emptied one magazine out of my rifle, my M16, and then I loaded another magazine. And when I was loading the second magazine in that brief interlude, mm-hmm. It took to do that, the NVA shot me in the side, hit me in the left side, and it was like getting hit by a sledgehammer and just knocked me over. My rifle went one way and I went the other. The AK round opened up a hole in my side about 6 inches. Fortunately, it did not penetrate my stomach.
Can we stop for a second?
Sure.
How far away are the people firing at you?
I don't know where they are. I can just hear bullets coming in. The scrub brush was probably no more than about 20 feet away. Where they were, I couldn't see them. I could just hear a lot of fire, and there was also fire coming in at the my men that were in the ditch. So we were basically surrounded.
That's right. You're almost on top of them.
Right.
Describe how it feels to be hit by that AK-47 round. You sound like a sledgehammer.
It was like I'd never been hit so hard in my life. It was just the force of the round hitting the body just was like just getting knocked over.
Does it hurt, sting? I mean, is there a bullet pain, or is it just the force of the blast knocks you?
That particular wound, I did not feel at all. It was just the force of the blast just knocking your body backwards.
What are you thinking, feeling when you hit the ground?
I was just stunned. Mm-hmm. And then so I got up and I crawled over to my rifle and I'm firing again, and I decided that this is not going to work. I'm just totally outgunned. I'm out in the open. And so I started dragging this guy back to the ditch and firing behind me, you know, pointing the rifle behind me as I'm, I'm yelling to my men, cover me, get some fire out this way towards me. And so I remember getting just to the edge of the ditch, thinking to myself, ha-ha, you bastards, I made it. And just then I got shot in the lower right leg, and the bullet went in one side and out the other, breaking the tibia and the fibula.
Hmm. Now, what did that one feel like? That's different.
That hurt like hell. I tumbled into the ditch, and with some help, we got the guy into the ditch. And that one really hurt because the tibia and the fibula bones were sticking out of the leg, and the lower right leg was just like jelly. And I think it's from the trauma of the wound. The whole leg was, the lower leg was just shaking, and it hurt like hell. So
you're immobilized, I take it.
I'm immobile. I can't even fire anymore. I'm just laying in the ditch. I can't even fire up. The leg hurts so bad. So my one squad leader, Sergeant Scherf, and that's S-C-H-E-R-F, crawled over, and I told him to take the boot lace out of my left foot and wrap both of my lower legs together to try to put some stability to that leg because it was just throbbing all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And just as he did that, he looked up at me, and he's laying in the ditch, but he looked up at me, and he said, don't worry, you're going to be all right. I'm going to get you out of this. And just then he caught a round in the head.
Oh, God.
Apparently his head was just a little too far above the ditch looking at me, and he caught an AK round in the head, and he just put his hand to his head. No noise, no nothing. It was the strangest thing. And he just put his hand to his head like when you have a headache, and he just lowered his head at my feet, and then he died.
God.
And
what do you do?
Well, at that point, I was completely helpless. I couldn't move. He was on my feet. I couldn't fire, so I'm just trying to yell instructions to the to my radio operator down at the other end of the ditch,
mm-hmm.
and the other squad leader who was left, and that's Sergeant Bakovich. When all of that was going on, that I was over by the loach looking around, Sergeant Bakovich decided he needed that M60 machine gun that was lying out in the open with the dead gunner.
Yeah.
And so he ran out to retrieve the machine gun. And just as he got to the machine gun, there was a North Vietnamese soldier that was walking out of the bush with the same idea to get the machine gun.
Wow.
But Bakovich saw him first, and so he shot the NVA, grabbed the machine gun, and jumped back in the ditch. It was interesting because my radio operator, this was the first time he was in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was, since this was just going to be a road clearing operation, it would be a good way for him to get some experience without getting into anything heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Little did I know.
Yeah, he's jumping right into it.
Yeah. And we thought it was funny because this radio operator was just short of getting a PhD in chemistry and chemical engineering. And we always, when he showed up at the company, we wondered how the hell did he get into the Army? You know, he was just short of the only thing he needed was a dissertation,
mm-hmm.
and he would have had his PhD in chemical engineering.
Okay.
And his name was Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm yelling to Zimmerman to what to say on the radio that, you know, if they don't get in quick, we're dead, we're done. Because we were clearly surrounded. I also learned that before I got back to the ditch, the NVA had thrown a grenade into the ditch, and Bakovich was able to throw it out before it went off. Bakovich told me later, many years later when I found him, that they were flying a plane overhead, a Piper Cub, with a loudspeaker, telling all units, friendly units, to mark their positions. What had happened was, now bear in mind that the only intelligence I had for this mission was that there were some Viet Cong tax collectors along the road.
Right.
As soon as the helicopter got shot down, the word got up to division, and the division intelligence people said, oh, yeah, in that grid square, we think there might be a portion of a North Vietnamese regimental headquarters. And they learned that from radio intercepts from the radio stations they had, that the frequency of the radio transmissions coming out of that area would be of a type of radio that would be at a regimental headquarters.
Okay.
So in short order, they had fighter bombers dropping 500-pound bombs all over the area. They radioed to Bakovich with the radio operator, you know, where should we drop them? And Bakovich is, he doesn't even know where he's at, and he's saying, just drop them anywhere. They're all around us. I learned from the first sergeant the following day when I came out of surgery that the pilots of these fighter bombers were shouting like a bunch of kids because they were just NVA running all over the place. And so they were having a field day. Apparently, we did hit a we did land in a portion of a regimental headquarters, but the NVA were smart enough never to put too many people in one location because of our firepower. So we did run into a portion of that. After about, as near as I can tell, maybe a half hour from landing, armored personnel carriers finally broke into the area we were at. And these armored personnel carriers were working the Tra Bong Road and the road clearing operation as well, but they were further east of us. And so when we went in on the helicopter to go after the crew, the battalion commander contacted these three armored personnel carriers and told them to go in as well. They thought that they were the only ones going in. They did not know that we had already gone in there. The other thing that I remember is the helicopter pilot of the gunship that was flying overhead that followed us in, I finally contacted him many years later. And he said that he felt helpless because he could see the NVA were so close to us that he was limited in where he could fire for fear of hitting us. So after about a half hour, the three personnel carriers came into the area, formed a quick wagon wheel, a circle, and they just wanted to get us on the choppers and get out. They were going to leave the dead behind. They didn't want to be there, you know, they were afraid, and I refused to be moved until they got the dead out as well. And I screamed at them. Of course, I may have been in shock at that point, I don't know. But I screamed at them, don't touch me until you get the dead in. So the one helicopter, they put me inside the one armored personnel carrier, they put me inside. They left the door ramp down, and they put the dead on the door ramp so that I would be protected from ground fire. And then off we went back towards the Tra Bong Road. And Sergeant Bakovich got into the armored personnel carrier I was in as we went back towards the Tra Bong Road. And I remember telling him, I said, Bakovich, I'm going to put you in for a medal. And typical GI, he said, sir, I'll trade the medal for 3 days in the rear.
Oh, wow.
That's all you think about. You know, medals meant nothing. You know, for him to be able to be in the rear for a couple of days and get a shower, that would be fine. That would be a reward enough. When we got across where the scrub brush was close to the road, a medevac helicopter landed, and all the dead were put in on the floor, and then I was put in on a stretcher in the helicopter, and then we went back to the hospital.
Are you taking in morphine or anything like that? Are you still in pain? Are you in?
No. As I can recall, I was not given any morphine. By then, it was funny because my leg hurt so much. They had to take one of their cots out of the armored personnel carriers and put me on the cot, and then they folded the cot around me to stabilize my body so my leg wouldn't wiggle. And that's how they put me back in the armored personnel carrier. And then when they put me on the helicopter, the medevac, they kept me in the same cot that they took out of the personnel carrier,
mm-hmm.
because my leg was just hurting so bad. It was almost in two. It was just the skin holding it and some muscle. And so whoever I took the cot from in the armored personnel carrier never got it back. So they put me in the helicopter, and off we went. I remember arriving at the hospital, and they prepped me for surgery, and I remember pleading with the nurse, you know, to save my leg, and she said, "We'll do what we can," and they were just cutting my pants off and everything, and then they put an airbag around my bad leg and, like, pulled a cylinder that air came in and it hurt like hell when it was filling up with air, but once the bag was full, my leg felt like $1 million because it put pressure on the leg and it moved the bones back in place.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the lieutenants came in from the battalion to see me, and I was more concerned about the leg. And then that's when he told me, and it never dawned on me, he said, "You have a side wound as well."
Had you forgotten that?
I had forgotten about it.
And apparently it wasn't bleeding too bad, I guess?
I don't know. It was bleeding, but, you know, it was a flesh wound,
mm-hmm.
more than a stomach wound. And so I went into surgery, and then the next day is when the company commander came in with the first sergeant, and my first sergeant told me about the NVA that were there. Later in the morning, the battalion commander came in with our battalion surgeon, and I was sitting up at that point, and he told me he was up all night thinking if he had made the right decision. And of course, I didn't know the conversation he had with my company commander until later, years later.
Mm-hmm.
But I told him, I said, "Well, sir, you did the right thing, because if I were shot down, I'd certainly want somebody to come in after me."
Sure.
And I think that that meant a lot to him, and I think that gave him comfort.
Mm-hmm.
So I was after a couple days there, then I was moved down to Da Nang, I was moved down to Cameron Bay in the process of being shipped to Camp Zama, Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I remember at Cameron Bay, I was there for a day or so. On the other side of my ward were all of these South Korean soldiers, and some of them were pretty well shot up.
Mm-hmm.
When an officer comes to an American soldier in bed, I mean, the American soldier is kind of just laying there and, you know, and talks to the officer. But on that other side where the Koreans were, when a Korean officer came in to see them, no matter how bad they were, they sat up in bed. And that's the kind of discipline they have.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So I was sent to Camp Zama, Japan, where I spent about a week. And my leg hurt quite a bit, and they gave me pain pills. And I think it was the second day that the doctor came on his rounds, and he said, "Taylor, does that leg still hurt?" And I said, "Yeah, it still hurts." And he stared at the leg, and then he started yelling, "Goddamn son of a bitch." And here they had set the leg wrong.
Oh, no.
And that's why it was hurting. It wasn't quite in line. So he drew a line on the cast. He said, "Cut this cast and reset this leg."
And so, what are you thinking here, Dave?
Well, I'm thinking, no wonder it hurts so much, you know. And so that's what they did. They reset the leg, and then after that I was just fine.
Uh-huh. Wow. Are you thinking about getting back at the field? I mean,
Yeah, I did not want to go home.
I was assuming that, but I wanted.
I was pissed off that I had to leave my men, and I'm thinking, I wonder how long it would take to get my leg done. Maybe I can get it healed here at Camp Zama and then go back to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
At the other end of the ward that I was at was this helicopter pilot who had been wounded in the foot.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, he was the pilot that took us in to the down Loach.
Really?
He was our battalion commander's helicopter pilot.
Right.
And what happened, I talked to him in the ward in Camp Zama, Japan,
mm-hmm.
and his plan was to hover there in the area until we checked out the crew and then get the crew back on his helicopter with my men, and then he was going to take off. And he is the one that told me he saw the ditch, and he decided to drop us off above the ditch. And he was shot. He received a lot of fire on his helicopter, and he was shot in the foot. And he decided if he hovered there much longer, he would be shot down on top of us. So he told his other helicopter pilot, his co-pilot, to take off. And he said, I hated to leave you there, but if I stayed any longer, I was going to be shot down on top of you.
Hmm.
And I apologized to him for being shot and wounded, taking us in. And he said, don't worry. He said, I guess they're putting me in for a Bronze Star. I got a Purple Heart. And my brother is stationed here in Japan, and he's bringing a Japanese girlfriend over here to be with me. And I thought to myself, God bless the aviators.
Yeah, really, this guy's set up.
And sure enough, that afternoon, I saw this gorgeous-looking Japanese girl come
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
and spent the day with him by his bed. And I think it was only a day later that he was able to start taking some overnight trips out of the hospital. And so he did just fine.
It sounds like he did.
The other memory I have from the hospital in Camp Zama, Japan, we would, gradually start talking to each other in our beds, how did you get hit, what happened to you, that kind of thing. And the guy to the right of me was a captain, and to the right of him was this black helicopter pilot who had been wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And so the helicopter pilot and I are talking to this captain about how he got wounded. He was a West Point career officer. That was his third tour.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been shot. A bullet entered his helmet, went into his skull, down through his jaw, around, and went out the other side of the jaw.
Wow.
And it was, and he was fine. He had mentally, he was fine. They wired his jaw closed, so he could hardly talk. But he, it would be a long process for him to be healed,
mm-hmm.
But he would be okay. And he was moaning and groaning how he hated to be wounded because he wanted to get back to the field. And this black helicopter pilot is looking at him, and he said, sir, are you a religious man? And the guy's, well, kind of. He said, if I were you, I'd be on my knees praying that you're even here.
Yeah.
But that was my sentiment. And then about my second day I was there, the chaplain came by, and he asked me if I had written home that I had been wounded. And I said no. And at this time in Vietnam, because of so many parents having heart attacks and those kinds of things, when their sons had a minor wound, they would get a telegram. And just the fact of getting a telegram before they even read the telegram, sometimes they would have a heart attack and die.
Mm.
There was a policy that was initiated that if you did not want your parents to be notified unless the wounds were very, very serious, you could sign the form, and I had signed the form. And so they were not notified. And so I was very bitter. that I was had to leave Vietnam, but this chaplain talked me into writing a letter home. So I wrote a letter home telling him that I had been wounded and I'd be coming home.
Did you go into the details of exactly what had happened, or that, you know, this was pretty serious, or what did you say?
No, I soft-pedaled it. I just said that I had been shot in the leg, and that it wasn't going to allow me to the leg would be fully healed, but it would take too long, and so they were sending me home.
Okay.
And I kind of left it at that.
Tell me how you thought about going home.
I was very bitter. I did not want to go home. At that point, I had decided that once my field duty was over, rather than be sent to the rear for 6 months in a rear job, which was the custom, I was going to try to get into the Vietnamese advisor school, which was down in Quang Nai City, not too far from us, and spend a six-month tour as a Vietnamese advisor.
Okay.
And then maybe stay longer if I could get a company command.
Right.
And, of course, all of that was lost. But the biggest disappointment was I left my men into the field, and God knows what kind of leader they were going to get. And that's what bothered me the most. They were my men, and I didn't want to go home until they went home.
What about the? I've heard this from a number of people who were wounded in a manner like you, as far as just being removed immediately from the field, and you're back to a hospital, and you're there for an indeterminate length of time. One of the things that it's very hard for them to deal with is fact if they are sent home, or if they're in a long-term recuperation mode or period. They lose contact with their men. Not only can they not go back, you know, in a short period of time and rejoin them and go forward with them in whatever operations they're going to do, but if they go back home like you, you lose touch. I mean, that's it. If you don't have your address book completely filled out, these guys are gone.
Right.
What do you do like that? Was that your case?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I was not that close to my men, but I would like to have kept in contact with them, and also my company commander and another platoon leader that I became very close with.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, all of that is lost.
Mm-hmm.
I did have a roll of film that I had taken, and it was at the Chu Lai getting developed at the PX. And I wrote a letter back to the company commander asking if he could get those pictures and send those to me. It was a roll of film where I had worked with a Vietnamese company out on the Batangan Peninsula with the company commander, and also it had some airstrikes. We dropped napalm once in a little valley, and I was sitting on the side of the hill kind of watching the show, taking pictures. And I valued those pictures, and he had written me a letter saying that all of the photos were destroyed because we had walked across a little river, and the water came up to our chest, and I had forgotten to take the camera and put it inside a battery bag, and so all the film was destroyed.
Oh, no.
So I came out of that with virtually no pictures. But yeah, the whole disappointment, I felt I was cheating the government and cheating my men by not putting my time in. And I was very bitter about it.
Have you gotten over it?
No. Still to this day, I wish I would have put my year in. But you know, God sometimes has other plans, and the fact that I was sent home early like that to the hospital at Fort Dix, New Jersey, where I was from, New Jersey, I met my wife, who was an Army nurse there, and we've been married for 35 years, so who knows who I would eventually have married had I stayed in Vietnam and how that would have worked. So I think sometimes you got to be open to God's will and not your own.
Yeah, I mean, what else could you do? I mean, medically, you didn't have a choice here, I don't think.
Right, right. Yeah, I asked the doctors in Kamzama, Japan, how long would it take to heal my leg, and they said about a year, and you're going home. And that's in fact, both as a patient and as an outpatient at Fort Dix, it took me a year to get those bones healed up, since both of them were shattered.
two questions about that. One, physically, how are you today?
The Army did a good job. The bones, when you get that kind of a break and lose bones, they don't grow back together. They kind of grow on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so on my right leg, I lost about a half inch.
Okay.
But the leg became so calcified that the leg was probably stronger than the other leg.
Hmm.
And I was able to go in the Army Reserve Special Forces for 22 years. And I was able to get by with all the runs because I was just at that point where a half inch, the spine would adjust without having to use lifts in your shoe or anything
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Although at the end, the last 2 years of my reserve duty, my ankle and my knee started to hurt from all that extra pounding through the years when I was running for physical fitness tests and that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Second question, you said you had not gotten over this, still to this day, that you're kind of struggling with this. I don't want this to sound like an obvious question, but why is that? Obviously they're emotionally, physically, but tell me a little bit more about that.
I think that I missed my men.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to have been there to help them get through their tour. I think that's the main reason. And secondly, I was planning to be a career soldier,
mm-hmm.
and I missed opportunities that, opportunities for field experience that I should have had. I remember later, about a month and a half after I was wounded, the entire battalion went on an operation in the Trabong Mountains against an NVA regiment. May have been part of the same regiment that I found, but they located an NVA hospital
mm-hmm.
and a bunch of other things, and I kind of wished when I found that out when I was at the Fort Dix Hospital, some men from the battalion came through there and we talked. Then I was really upset that I missed out on that as a career soldier. That was a battalion size operation,
mm-hmm.
and that would have been interesting to be on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you made colonel, right?
Well, I
mean, you had a long, successful career after this, and your men. When you say you miss your men, do you miss them as they were that day you left them, or do you? You've been able to reconnect with some of them.
Yeah, after a while, you kind of bury all of that, and you get on with the mission of life. I was married, and I was trying to develop a career in the business world. I decided not to stay in the Army. After Fort Dix, my wife and I, well, my fiance and I, were both assigned to Fort Jackson, South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
where I was in charge of the Small Arms Training Committee for the 3rd Advanced Individual Training Brigade, and my wife worked at the hospital. At that point, they were bringing in the volunteer army concept, which was known as Volar.
Mm-hmm.
And the standards just fell out of the roof. I mean, the standards were lowered
yeah.
because they wanted people to feel like this was an 8-10 job, 8-5 job.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't the Army that I joined, and I decided that this whole transition to a volunteer Army, which would be ugly for at least 8 years, that would be the key portion of my career. And so I just didn't want to deal with it, so I got out.
Mm-hmm.
I finished my college at the University of South Carolina
mm-hmm.
After I got out until my wife was finished her military tour. And I interviewed with the B.F. Goodrich Company,
mm-hmm.
Which was located in Ohio, where my wife was from.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no desire to go back to New Jersey. It was too crowded. And so I went to work for B.F. Goodrich and spent 28 years working for them and a company that my division was spun off to.
Mm-hmm.
In the business world, I did want to continue some military activity in the reserve because of all the work I had done with all the training I had. And the only infantry reserve unit in the state of Ohio was Special Forces. Mm-hmm. They had a Special Forces Battalion. Mm-hmm. And so I applied and I got into the Special Forces Battalion and I went to the different training that was required and I became Special Forces qualified.
Okay. Dave, why don't we take a break for a moment, and when we come back, we can talk about some more Vietnam-related issues.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I need to take a pee break.
Okay. All right. Hold on one second. Okay, Dave, continuing. Tell me, when you got back to New Jersey, I want to ask about two things specifically. One, how much did you keep up with the war and what was happening? And two, I want to know about how you met your wife. If you want to talk about the second issue.
Yeah, sure. I tried to keep up with the war as much as I could. The only chance I had to learn what my unit was doing, my battalion, was if I were to find somebody coming through the hospital from that battalion, and that happened two or three times. But other than that, it was hard to know what was happening with my men.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, after a fashion, when I met my wife, I got more involved in trying to develop a life with her and
mm-hmm.
and getting on with my healing and my military assignments and that kind of thing. I met my wife at the hospital. That her family thought that she was the one who nursed me back to health. But in fact, I met her at a party. When I was on outpatient status, I stayed in the nurse's quarters, which was across the lawn from the hospital.
That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, it was. I mean, about half of the quarters were empty of nurses because they were all in Vietnam. And so people like me who are on outpatient status were placed in those quarters so we didn't have far to go to get to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And it made for a delightful time. At the end of the workday, we'd always, in the warm weather, we'd get out there. They had some picnic tables and some other things, and somebody would bring over a bunch of beer, and we'd just sit around and talk. In those days, you were either coming back from Vietnam or you were going to Vietnam. And my roommate and I decided to host a party one night. So we had all the booze and everything in our room, and it was kind of a come one, come all, just walk in the door. And future wife walked in. She had just been assigned there not too long. She was taking the operating room nurse's course at Fort Dix. And she came in. Her date was an artillery officer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we met there. I had been sufficiently drunk, but asked her for a dance, and I danced with her. And at that point in time, I had a full-length leg cast on my bad leg,
mm-hmm.
and I was not supposed to put any weight on it. I had two crutches.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had been drinking so much that I just threw the crutches away, and I was just dancing on the leg, feeling no pain.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, my roommate, there were two of us. We had two bedrooms, a common sitting area, and a kitchenette for the rooms, and my roommate was an orthopedic surgeon that worked at the hospital. And so, because these were officer quarters, and so the next morning I got up and I had this pain in my leg, and I looked down and here the whole cast had cracked.
Oh.
But I didn't feel it the night before.
Right.
And my roommate came over from his room and he looked at me and he says, "You infantry types are all the same." And so he went over to the hospital and brought back some plaster of Paris and patched up my leg. Now, you know, had he reported me, I could have been in serious trouble.
Yeah.
But you don't do that to buddies, but
mm-hmm.
but anyway, my fiance was across the lawn in another building, and so I made contact with her and we started to date and everything, and then it got serious. And this I met her in October of 1969. And by January, we were engaged, and we got married the following July.
Wow.
So it was a short courtship. But we felt we were right for each other, and I guess we were.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
What kind of reception did you have when you came home? I mean, you went, I guess, military transport?
Right. I was fortunate in the sense that I did not have to put up with any of the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I was unfortunate that I came back the way I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget this. The plane left Camp Zama, Japan, went through Alaska, and eventually ended up at Fort Dix at the airbase next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were placed in a hospital bus with a lot of stretchers, and were driven to the Fort Dix Hospital, Walson Army Hospital. It's Walson.
Mm-hmm.
And the bus pulled up to the dock. It was late at night, and the doors opened, and this Army major came into the bus. His chest was full of medals, including, I think he had a Distinguished Service Cross, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, on behalf of the commanding general of Fort Dix, New Jersey, and myself, we want to welcome you home and thank you for serving your country. And to me, that's all I required.
Right.
And as they were wheeling me out from the bus, I just looked down and I said, thank you. I appreciate it. To me, that was all that I required. That was man to man, soldier to soldier. And, I felt good about that. Most people didn't even get that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. Over the years, have you shared that with other veterans in the AmeriCal Division, Veterans Association, or others?
Only when it comes up. I don't go out of my way to express that. Yeah.
Okay. How long were you there, first of all, recovering?
I was there a year.
At Fort Dix.
At Fort Dix. After about 6 months or so, then I went on outpatient status. And so I wouldn't be bored. The medical company at Fort Dix was actually a battalion-sized unit. They had medical personnel all over New Jersey and New York, headquartered at Fort Dix. And so the training officer, who was an MSC officer, was leaving, and so I volunteered to be the training officer so I could have something to do during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did, and so it worked out fairly well while I was there. My roommate in the my second roommate when I was bedridden was a helicopter pilot who had been shot in the leg, and the bullet traveled up the leg and out the upper thigh, and his leg looked like the Grand Canyon.
Mm.
And I became close to him, and it was nip and tuck for him whether or not they could keep the leg. But they finally did keep it, although, I mean, it looked ugly as sin. I mean, it was just a big gouge in the leg all the way up, but he was able to eventually keep it. And this man was a warrant officer, and warrant officers know a lot. They know all the ins and outs of the Army. And he told me that since I was going to be there a year, I could apply for disability, Social Security disability. And that's what I did. So I think I ended up, towards the end of my year tour, I think I ended up getting a check for about $1,500,
mm-hmm.
which was a nice piece of change in those days.
Yeah, definitely.
My first roommate, when I was first brought into Fort Dix, I was put into a room. It was a young kid next to me, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. And I think it was the next day after I was there, his wife visited him, who was a very pretty young girl from northern New Jersey. And after she left, one of the orderlies came in, and I whispered to him, "What's wrong with this kid?" And he said, "Well, he just couldn't make it through basic training. He just got too traumatized by the situation. He was having a mental breakdown."
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the orderly, and I said, "You get me the fuck out of this room." or I will be beating on him, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, well, this is the room you're assigned. And I said, I'm telling you. So his boss, a black sergeant, a medic, came in, and I said, I do not want to be in the same room with this man.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't question it, and he got me out, and then he put me in with that helicopter pilot, which
mm-hmm.
was great.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
But as I mentioned earlier, I went to Fort Jackson, got out, went into finished my college,
mm-hmm.
and went to Ohio to work for B.F. Goodrich.
Yeah.
I joined the Army Special Forces Reserve, where I ended up putting in a career for 22 years in the reserve. And I think for me that helped a lot because I still had a part of the military in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't totally divorced of the military, and I think hindsight that was good for me because the military meant so much to me. Had I been totally divorced from it and just gone back into civilian life, I think maybe I would have struggled more with the Vietnam experience than what I did.
And you're also a leader in the AmeriCal Division Veterans Association.
Yes, this only happened maybe 3 or 4 years ago. I became active in that
mm-hmm.
because I was retired. My children were grown out of the house, and I had more time, and I'm just really enjoying it.
That's great. Tell me about your transition to civilian life back then. You know, what was that like? Was it hard for you when you went to work for BF, or actually when you went back to college?
College, it was interesting because you had two types of students, and I had 2 years of college before I went into the Army, so I wanted to get my remaining 2 years for a bachelor's degree so I could get into the workforce. And having been in Vietnam and being married, I had a sense of purpose. And the other veterans at the university, like me, that had been to Vietnam, all were the same way. We wanted to get our degrees and get out. I finished 2 years of college in 14 months with a 3.5 academic average
mm-hmm.
In the business school. And they brought in the computers and everything else, so we were leading edge, even though it was University of South Carolina. They had an excellent business school.
Mm-hmm.
And so the veterans, all we did was study hard, and we just wanted to get on with our lives. And then you had the other students on the campus that were just out of high school,
mm-hmm.
and they wouldn't show up for class till about 11 o'clock in the morning, whereas I would take all my classes starting at 8 in the morning back-to-back until lunch, and then I'd spend the rest of the day at home studying until about 10 o'clock at night.
So very disciplined.
Very disciplined, very focused. We wanted to get on with our lives. Not a lot of anti-war sentiment at the University of South Carolina. There was some. Mainly any relationships I had with other students were with other ex-vets.
Okay.
And the same thing at B.F. Goodrich. I met a number of folks that were out of the Army that had been in Vietnam. And so the transition was good for me.
Do you think that was typical of veterans in general across the country when they went back to school after they were discharged?
No, I've talked to veterans. A lot of them became very disenchanted with the college because as soon as the colleges and this other students found out they were Vietnam veterans, they were pretty hard on them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you had the college professors with all this anti-war rhetoric and everything else. And so a number of these students were made to feel like they were second-class people.
Mm-hmm.
That I did not have that case. And the other good thing that happened to me was when I interviewed for the job at B.F. Goodrich,
mm-hmm.
The manager from B.F. Goodrich that came down to do the interviewing was a former infantry officer that had been to Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
And so I was the only veteran that interviewed that day. And so let's just say I had a plus up.
Mm-hmm. I would say so.
And so we got along just fine, and I was the only one invited to go up.
How much did you talk about your Vietnam experiences when you came back and after you left the hospital and you got back into civilian life, you're in college and then into B.F. Goodrich? How much discussion was there, first initially and then through the years?
I really never discussed it unless I came across someone else in the reserve or in the business world, if they were a veteran, that had been to Vietnam, I would discuss experiences with them. Mm-hmm. In the Army Reserve, many of the people I came in contact with had never gone to Vietnam, and so they would ask me, and I would share things with them.
Mm-hmm.
I would, other than that, I discussed it with no one.
By choice?
By choice.
Did that mood change over the over time?
Yeah, only in later years, I think, when my children grew up, and they would ask me questions, and I wouldn't want to share too much, but I'm at that point now where I share a lot. And frankly, one of the reasons I'm doing this oral interview is to leave that as a gift to my children, because with the process of an oral history, it requires you to really think mm-hmm. about it, and I think this would be a nice gift to give to them.
Absolutely. It's one of the reasons we do it as well. It's for you all and for your families. And I wanted to ask you that. Why the detail now? Is it because of them, or is it because of Dave Taylor, or is it because of history?
I don't know. I do want them to know, and this is an orderly fashion to collect all my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And also part of history, I think that there are still a lot of stereotypes of people's experiences in Vietnam, and they run across the board. It's very harmful to generalize in any direction. Certainly not everyone was gung-ho, and certainly not everyone was a drug head.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everyone had their own individual story. And so that's why I think it's important to get as many oral histories as possible.
Yes. Let me ask you some questions to get your reflections on some general Vietnam policies and issues.
Mm-hmm.
The anti-war movement, your thoughts?
I think it was, I understand why we had it. America is not culturally used to long wars, nor should we be. Otherwise, we would become a warrior state.
Mm-hmm.
I think that President Johnson should be blamed for much of what happened. He was a liberal president who would have preferred to have spent all his time and money on the Great Society, the liberal programs of the time, and yet he had this war, and he should have taken all of his time and his expertise and everything else to decide what to do about the war, either to get out or to push it forward to reach a successful conclusion,
mm-hmm.
and he did neither. And that is totally unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
We've learned that. And I think America's policies since then have been reflective of that. We're still learning the lesson, but I think the Vietnam is held up every time we have to decide on military action.
Do you think Kennedy or Nixon did better or worse than Johnson?
I think Kennedy, we just can't judge, because some historians say that he probably would never have gone into Vietnam the way we did. Others think that he would have. We just can't judge. Nixon, I think, gets a bad rap because he did bring it to a close as expeditiously as he could under the circumstances. And all of the liberal politicians like to blame Nixon when in fact they should be blaming their own liberal president, Johnson, who was far more responsible for the war than Nixon ever was.
Right. Okay. What about Vietnamization? You know, you're right there at the, you're getting out in 69, and, you know, 70, 71, Vietnamization's in full swing, trying to get the South Vietnamese to take over this war and fight it effectively. What do you think about that policy?
I think Vietnamization was good. The problem was we started it too late.
Mm-hmm.
The Marine Corps had the absolute correct idea with early starting into these combined action platoons or CAP teams. That was the right thing to do. And my experience with the CAP teams in our area, and we had a number of them, they were very, very effective. so I think we should have adopted that. The Marine Corps has a history of fighting small wars, insurgencies, and pacifying areas. It's in their bloodline. Mm-hmm. And I think they had the right idea. Not all CAP teams were as good as others, but it was the right concept, the right idea. And I think the Army should have adapted that as well. In addition to using main forces to wipe out the big formations wherever we could find them, mm-hmm. and had we done that, I think we would have been a lot further ahead than we were.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just trying to recall a comment I read from somebody on an email who was with a armored cavalry troop. And he made the observation that when he was there in 1970, they saw very little action. He said, you know, the enemy had been beaten down so much that, it was hard to find them. And his question was, so why did we leave? And it begs the question, because as we know, we never lost a military battle. Mm-hmm. And it was several years later that the North Vietnamese government came out and admitted that they probably lost about 1 million men, mm-hmm. and they had around 600,000 wounded. Mm-hmm. And so, but we got to that point too late, after too much time, and so we lost it.
Do you think we achieved peace with honor? And then I'm quoting, Kissinger, Nixon.
No, I would not. I don't think we did then. I think with history, to some degree, we did achieve peace with honor. Mm-hmm. Looking back at what happened as a result of our sacrifice of Vietnam, mm-hmm. At the time, I don't think. At the time we were getting out of Vietnam, I don't think anyone believed we were achieving peace with honor. Mm-hmm. And I do fault Kissinger. I don't think he was very honest in the way we left Vietnam and leaving all the MIA issue wide open and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But it was a sign of the times. People were just sick of the war, and we would get out at any price.
What do you think of the media coverage of the war?
I think it was very unfair. I remember one officer at Fort Jackson telling me that he had been over there. He was a major, and I think he was with the 1st Cavalry Division, and they had just had a major fight. And before that fight, the reporters that were with them would ask the GIs, what do you think about the war? And the general response was always, hey, I don't particularly want to be in a war, but I'm here, and I'm going to do the best job I can and do the best I can to get home. And that was the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what the media wanted, apparently. After this major battle, this major told me that the media came in that had been with this unit before the battle, and saw this one soldier sitting on a rock with his head buried in his hands because he lost his best friend. And the reporter came over with a cameraman, and he stuck the microphone in this kid's face, and he said, now what do you think of the war? And so, and this major saw this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if I thought I was against the media, I wouldn't want to be a reporter in front of this major, because he never forgot that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think by and large, the media did not do a good job. There are exceptions, but I think they were a reflection of the society in general and the frustration that the American society was witnessing.
Yeah. What do you think of the one-year rotation policy? This is very different for past wars. Do you think that was effective in Vietnam?
I think it was a mistake. I think it should have been more like a possibly a 14 or 16-month rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And the officers should have stayed in the field longer. Having said that, I mean, the officers as it was, we had a rapid turnover of junior officers. They just didn't last that long. But we kept relearning the lessons. There was very little institutional memory for the ground troops. You get a new officer in, and I witnessed this myself in the Batangan Peninsula. You developed an expertise in working in the heavily mined areas. You gained a sixth sense. You could smell the enemy. You could sense it. And yet after 6 months, you leave and some brand new officer comes in. And as well trained as he may have been, it takes him a while to gain that sense. And that comes at a price. So, yeah, I think we should have stayed in the field longer. But it was not to be.
Right. The body count policy, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with it, the government basically saying, or the military commander saying, you know, we can measure, one way to measure progress in the war is to count the number of enemy killed, and if we continue to wear them down, you know, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, then eventually they're going to run out. They're going to, and they will lose their will to continue the fight. Was this kind of attitude, strategy effective when it was really going basically from 65 to just post-Tet? This is before you were there, but I just wanted to get your opinion on it.
Yeah, that I think that was an outgrowth of Westmoreland's conventional view towards the war. And other division commanders and brigade commanders, the same thing. So success was measured by body count. And so you had some more, some of the aggressive commanders, wanted those body counts regardless. From what I know from my battalion, and it changed from battalion commander to battalion commander, but generally speaking in my battalion, body counts were not pushed. What we placed more emphasis on was to control an area and keep the Viet Cong from coming into the area to influence the civilians in the area.
Right.
And certainly at the time I was there in 1969, it was kind of hard to get a body count because the Viet Cong were very elusive. If you were able to find them and kill, let's say, three or four, that was considered to be a pretty good job.
Yeah.
And so that's the stage the war had gotten down to. And so we were more concerned about keeping the Viet Cong out of the populated areas so that the rice harvests could be gotten and those kinds of things.
Dave, I'd like to ask you a couple of more personal questions. Answer them only if you feel comfortable and want to. Have you experienced in your 30-plus years, or not quite that much yet, of being back, PTSD incidents? Anything like that going on for you?
No, nothing at all. The only thing is loud sounds. Cause me concern, but that's probably from Vietnam, but I know people that have never been to Vietnam, that's the same issue. And that was a problem early on, the first 2 years after I got back from Vietnam. Loud noises and sounds would upset me. But other than that, no, I've been very blessed. I think part of it has to do with my faith. I was married in 1970, never went to church. My wife went every week as a good Catholic. But I, you know, I was an airborne ranger. I didn't need church. And up until, that is, the spring of 1975, when my wife was at school at night and I was at home watching our baby, and the final offensive where the North took over the South, and I know one night I was looking at the TV, that view of the helicopter landing on top of that building in Saigon, and the last people getting on the helicopter to go out, and I had just lost it because I thought we should have won it, we could have won it. If we were willing to stay, just like we stayed in Korea, until that country stabilized itself politically, economically, I think we could have made it happen. But we abandoned them. And when I saw that image on TV, and I thought about all those people that died for nothing, and so I lost it and kind of fell to the floor. And so I started going to church, and I've been on that faith journey ever since. So I think that that was a big help to me.
That was a catalyst event for you finding some deeper spirituality?
Absolutely.
April 30th, 75?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was in, it happened, it was in the Easter season, and all of that kind of came together for me.
How has Vietnam most affected you, Dave, do you think, looking back?
Probably has affected my personality in the sense that I don't put up with a lot of bullshit.
Is that you, the military, or is it Vietnam or a combination?
I think it's probably a combination. I tend to be, as my daughter says, anal retentive, very detailed oriented, planning always ahead. You know, I try not to take too many risks. And I think that all stems from being a small unit leader where you don't, you know, you always got to be thinking about what's down the road. But it hasn't been so much of that that it, I think, has been really in a negative way. It's just the way I am.
Right. What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned while you were there in Vietnam? And it might echo what you just said, but is there something you can put your finger on that Dave Taylor did not have really consciously, at least, before you went, and then something you've had since?
I think the one thing as a military professional is the value of training. I felt very trained and able to do the job over there, and I saw some of my enlisted personnel that were not highly trained, and how I had to get them trained. I think also the value of motivation. When we got into the 69 time frame when I was over there, my men were not very aggressive. They were just trying to get through their year, and so I had to be the aggressive one for the platoon. But I didn't get them in the harm's way. It's just that if you look back in the early years from 65 and 66 and those kinds of things, I mean, the men were over there, they had a mission, they were aggressive, just like they are in Iraq today. And it's like, okay, we have a mission, let's win this thing. And I've had soldiers tell me, officers tell me, I mean, if anybody had a beef against America, would be some of these kids coming out of the inner city. This one officer had Puerto Rican kids from New York. They were missing teeth and everything else, you know, from the ghettos. And if anybody had a reason to had a beef about having to go to war for a country that where they were not getting a lot from the country, it was these kids. But yet they were, I mean, they would put K-bar knives in their teeth and crawl down into these tunnels looking for the VC, and that's the way it was.
Dave, why is that? Why do you think that people today don't see the Vietnam veterans, and you guys over there, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old, doing this kind of stuff? I mean, doing serving the country, doing the same thing that veterans have done in all past wars for the United States and since.
Because we didn't complete it successfully. And, you know, in the early years, I'd say 65 to early 68, you had that aggressive spirit I just described, that soldiers thought it was still winnable and they wanted to be part of that. After that, you would still find that when units came under fire. People would find the courage to do what they had to do. They just weren't as aggressive without being pressed. But if pressed, they did do the job. And I think a lot of it has to do with the bonds they develop within the unit and the dishonor of letting each other down. And they all wanted to get home, but they wanted to make sure their buddy got home with them. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that created that spirit when it had to be there.
Right. Okay. Is there anything that you would change about your Vietnam experience, if you could?
Yeah, I would have zigged instead of zagged that day I was running to the ditch.
Uh-huh.
Other than that, I don't think I would have changed anything.
Okay.
I did the best I could. I wish the battalion commander would not have sent me in that day. I know why he did it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I forgot to mention, many years later, about 4 years ago, I contacted my company commander.
Oh,
company
yeah?
Commander.
Okay.
And he told me, one of the many things we talked about was that day the helicopter was shot down, and I told him, I remember that look of distress on his face. And I said, I never forgot that look. And you never said a thing when the battalion commander told me to go in. And he said the reason was when the battalion commander, when we were flying on the helicopter to come into your location, the battalion commander said, I'm going to have Taylor take some men on my helicopter and go in after that helicopter was shot down. And my company commander said, I argued with the battalion commander, don't do that. Once you send him in on the helicopter, you've lost all control.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get the armored personnel carriers that are further down the road, and I will put men on those, and we will go in overland so we have some control. And the battalion commander ruled him out. And so when they landed at my position, you know, my company commander had lost the argument, and he knew that it was going to be bad things happening.
Yeah.
You know, where he wanted to control it, and the battalion commander said, "No, I'm gonna do it my way."
Mm-hmm.
And so, and the other thing the company commander said was, the light observation helicopter pilot that contacted me, he was supposed to be remaining on LZ Gator with the gunship and only to come off of LZ Gator if we needed them. And the company commander was in charge of that operation, and he told that helicopter pilot, in no uncertain terms, you will not leave LZ Gator unless I call for you. Because the company commander wanted to control the situation. He did not want it to get out of hand. He just wanted to clear the road, get the convoys through, and get out. The helicopter pilot had heard on the radio back at the battalion that I was catching sniper fire,
mm-hmm.
and on his own, he decided to get in his helicopter and come down. He was not told to do that. And so my company commander was very upset that he disobeyed the directions he was given.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, he got himself killed and a number of other people.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, I mean, he was, I talked to other pilots in his unit since then, and, you know, he was an aggressive kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to go down where the action was, but, you know, that's what happened.
Right, right. Dave, you mentioned this before. Could you just, you know, tell me about what you think are the major lessons of the Vietnam War for the United States?
Never commit troops to war unless you're committed to win the war, to win the military action.
Mm-hmm.
Always have a sound objective that everyone can understand, and have an exit strategy. No, you got to be able to define what winning is,
mm-hmm.
when you've accomplished the objective. If you can't do that, don't even get involved.
Okay. Dave, let's take a brief break. Okay, Dave, let's continue. Mm-hmm. A couple questions about popular culture in Vietnam. Do you read books on Vietnam?
Yes.
Have you found any particularly revealing ones that you would want to discuss or talk about?
Let's see here. I've had some recent books that I'm working on now that look good. I thought that the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young,
mm-hmm.
was very good.
Mm-hmm.
Introspective book, Lewis Sorley's A Better War.
Yes.
I thought was excellent.
Okay.
the book If I Die in a Combat Zone by Tim O'Brien, who was in our battalion. I thought that was good. And, you know, there are a number of them, I think, that that are good. Some of them are, if they're written by people who were there, they may not be, they may not win any literacy awards or anything like that. But I think they all have value in terms of talking about the war and the context that they experienced it.
Okay. What about movies on Vietnam? Do you avoid those or do you watch them?
The movies, by and large, have been a big disappointment. And I remember many years ago when the movie Platoon came out, I was not only disappointed, I was angry because many mothers and fathers who lost their sons in Vietnam may have seen that movie and had been given the impression that this is the way it was. And it was just so far out, but the man who produced it or directed it, Oliver Stone, is so far out to the left. He had an agenda that overcame the reality. In fact, that particular movie, I came in contact with the company commander who actually commanded the company Oliver Stone was in and took him to task for the movie. And Oliver Stone's response was, well, I'm in Hollywood, I have creative license. And the company commander says, no, you don't. And the minute you introduce it at the beginning of the movie, you mention the actual battalion, designation. So you didn't give a fictitious unit. You actually gave a real battalion designation and a company designation. He said, from that point on, you had an obligation to be accurate, and you were not. And so this individual wrote a book about what really happened with the company when he was there to try to set the record straight. But I think, by and large, all of them were disappointing. The movie We Were Soldiers, I think, is good. It's still, factually, they got some things wrong for the necessity of Hollywood, I guess. But by and large, I think the movies on Vietnam were disappointing.
Okay. Do you think it's, I mean, how do you make a good movie on Vietnam? What would you say? Is that doable?
I think it's doable, and I think We Were Soldiers made a good attempt at it. I also think the movie Hamburger Hill was very good and accurate. Towards the end, it got a little off balance with the talking to the reporter on the hill at the end of the battle. I think that was a little off balance. But by and large, I think that gave a good portrayal of how the GIs lived and were buddies together, that kind of thing.
Okay. Dave, you went back to Vietnam in 1997. Have you been back at all since then?
I went back in 97 mainly to see the country as a tourist. I only stopped in the village where I was just for a few minutes, and then on top of my hill where my battalion base camp was, because I was on my way down the coastline to Quang Nai, so I didn't have a lot of time there. And then in September of 2003, I went back for 10 days, and I spent the entire time in the area that I was during the war. And this was in conjunction with getting more background information for my book, as well as just to take some time to really dwell on the ground, the people, and everything else. And that was a very fulfilling trip.
What was it like in 97, your first time back? What emotions did you experience when you were landing, I presume, in Hanoi, or did you go into Ho Chi Minh City?
Yeah, I came through Hanoi and then down to Da Nang. I was very nervous.
Why were you nervous?
I wasn't sure how the people would receive me. I wasn't sure how much I'd be able to get to see that I wanted to see. But by and large, the people were just very friendly. And I saw every bit as much as I wanted to see. So the one time that made me very nervous was the last night I spent in Da Nang before I was to head south, and that next day I knew that I would be able to locate LZ Gator and get up on that hill, as well as the village that I was at north of Gator, and I knew I'd be able to find that. I still had my map, and I was very apprehensive about that day. So as I did every day I was in Da Nang, I went to Mass, Catholic Mass, in the afternoon. About 3 blocks from my hotel, there was a large Catholic cathedral, Vietnamese, and the entire Mass was in Vietnamese. But I went there and had some things happen that I think were God incidents, and that just calmed, you know, made everything calm for me.
Can you talk about that? Okay, would you like to talk about that?
I was, what I would normally do every day when I go to Mass, there was a grotto outside the cathedral, and so I would go there first to pray the rosary, and then I would go into Mass, and then walk back to my hotel and, you know, find some place to eat. This time, I decided to go to the church to pray the rosary. And as I walked up to the church, there was this Vietnamese man just standing there. I had not seen him before. And he's waving at me to follow him. And I'm pointing to the church and the rosary in my hand, like as much to say, no, I'm going to go into the church and pray the rosary. And he shook his head no. He said, follow me. And I'm thinking, what's happening here? And so I followed him into this building next to the cathedral, and we're walking through the building and through these little corridors, and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? What's going on? And he finally came into this room with this priest that was on the other side of the room at his desk. Now, this priest had gray hair. He was old. He could have been the bishop for all I know. I don't know. But this Vietnamese man was chatting to this priest, and I would think it's because he saw me going to Mass every day, and I'm just like mesmerized with the whole thing, and I'm still holding a rosary in my hand. This kindly old priest got up, his kind eyes looking at me. He came over, he took the rosary out of my hand, went over and blessed it with holy water, and then gave it back to me. And at that moment, a country that was once a killing zone became a healing ground, and that just calmed me down, and I was ready to move on with the next day with the full confidence that I'd be able to get through it.
What was the other incident?
That was it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You said when you were coming in country, you were nervous and you didn't know how the people would treat you. Were you worried about you, Dave Taylor, the American, or you, Dave Taylor, the Vietnam veteran?
The American, because they did not know I was a veteran. Maybe they could surmise that. The one thing that comes to my mind when I flew into Hanoi, I remember during the war, Newsweek ran a cover story on the face of the Viet Cong. And on the cover was this Viet Cong soldier being pulled out of a spider hole or a tunnel, and he had this shock of black hair on him and these beady eyes, just very intense eyes. And so I get off the plane in Hanoi, and I go through customs, and here's this customs officer, and it's the same guy. Looks just like the guy that I remembered on that cover many years before. The shock of black hair, the intense look, you know, the beady eyes, and it's like, oh my. So, and then of course they had weapons hanging around, but I mean, he just looked at my passport and just waved me through. He didn't look at my luggage or anything. And so that kind of, well, I thought, well, if they're not going to mess with me, this will probably be a good trip.
You remember, I've been there a couple times in that airport, and this is the old, well, at least in 97, that would have been the old airport.
Yeah.
And you stand there in those lines, and they've got, they're kind of menacing looking, and well, not purposely, maybe, but maybe so. They're staring you down, they're in uniform. And you are thinking, now, what are they going to do? I can only imagine you as a veteran of the conflict, you know, thinking, this guy's going to harass me. He might give me a hard time. He might make this
That was
difficult.
In the back of my mind.
Yeah.
You know, and I can see I can see other veterans who may have had some mental difficulties or emotional difficulties, I should say, that may have unnerved them, that experience. But I don't recall in 2003 when I went, I didn't even see that. It was a much more modern situation, a much more friendly building, decor, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember that in 97, it was a bit unnerving.
Okay. Differences between Vietnam in 97 and 2003, anything stand out?
Night and day.
Yeah? How
night
so?
And day. When I went back in 97, I could find the village and the hooch I stayed in.
Mm-hmm.
Everything looked pretty much the way it did during the war. 6 years later, when I came back, I didn't recognize the place because they had, in that 6 years, they had developed a lot of cottage industries in the towns making brick. And so it was very difficult to find a Vietnamese house that was with thatched, what we call a hooch, in the war. They had all upgraded their housing to brick. You would have to go off the main highways into hinterland to find that. So I was just absolutely amazed at the turnover. The towns were bigger. There were some new roads out on the Batangan Peninsula that had just been built.
Mm-hmm.
They were building a refinery off the coast in the Batangan Peninsula in that area that was just so heavily mined.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the Vietnamese government had reached equilibrium where finally they were on the upturn in terms of improving their economy, and I think the socialist government had relaxed enough that now some capitalism could take hold, and the place was really starting to boom.
Do you think in the future of Vietnam you see more and more of a capitalist society and edging toward that democratic society or a Vietnamese-style democracy, or do you see the current government being able to succeed and keeping things going even after the current generation of leaders dies out?
No, I think it'll be a Vietnamese-style democracy down the road once the old line die off, and many of them are. And the reason I think that is very simple. When I was in Saigon my first trip back in 97,
mm-hmm.
I was at the roof of the Rex Hotel looking down at the main plaza in front of the city hall, Saigon City Hall, and at night the Vietnamese come out with their children when it's cooler, and they are all playing in the park and all this, and it became very apparent to me that all they want for themselves and their family is a better future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from the human heart, and that cannot be stopped. It's the yearning of the human heart to have freedom, to have a better future for their children, and I think that's what's going to drive it. And the Vietnamese don't want to, the Vietnamese government does not want to be left in the backwater of perhaps an antiquated system, much like Cuba is today under Fidel Castro.
Right.
And I think they're smart enough to see that. They've reunited their country. The only thing that will keep them from growing now is their own foolishness, and I don't think they're going to let that happen.
Okay. 80% of the country is under the age of 40.
Right.
I want to ask you another question based on my experience there. When I spoke to the younger generation, I'm talking high school, college, and graduate students, but also those in their 30s and 40s, the impression was they really wanted to move beyond the war. They really could not understand, you know, what they called my fascination with the war. And I, as much as I tried to explain that I was a history student of the war and a professional historian and trying to understand, they would smile and answer our questions, but then they would want to change the subject. And it was not because they were being monitored or they were felt uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, and they simply said, we want to move past. Why is it, my impression again, and you might have something different, why is it easier for the Vietnamese to move past this thing than it is for us, the Americans? After all, the war was fought there. In their country, they lost much more than we did.
Right. I agree, and I think it's because of that yearning of the human spirit. Mm-hmm. The government stand, of course, is the people are still suffering from Agent Orange and those kinds of things. The younger population, they just want to get on. They sense that they can have a great future. There's more opportunity available for them. And I think as young people everywhere, even in this country, that's more relevant to them than what happened in the past. I do remember also when I went back in 97, there were still more people alive that were there in the war. They were older, of course. And I spoke to some of them here and there. And as much as the government propaganda tried to paint a picture of the Americans being all wrong and the North Vietnamese being all right, and they do that in their museums with pictures of the My Lai massacre and those kinds of things, it was very apparent to me that the new generation could see past that. There's enough people on the side of the South, the American side, during the war, that have passed down through their families the sacrifice of the Americans, the harshness of the communists, the brutality of the communists, during the war, and all those, their massacres, that all of the government propaganda is not going to erase that memory passed down from generation to generation. And so I think many of the people in the South have a much more balanced view of what actually happened there than what the government propaganda would suggest. But at this point in time, as you suggest, people want to get beyond all of that and just, you know, make a life better for themselves.
That makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's almost kind of a logical conclusion to what the human heart wants and desires.
Absolutely. And that's the genius of the, I think, our creation, that we can yearn for something better and not spend too much time dwelling on the past.
Have you had much contact with Vietnamese here in the United States, Dave?
No, we have a Vietnamese community in the Cleveland, Ohio area. I've not gone out of my way to cultivate any connections there.
You've touched on this in one of your recent previous answers, but let me ask us anyway. I think you can provide some good insight because of your involvement with the AmeriCal Association, as well as traveling back to Vietnam and looking at this bigger context. What do you think are the major myths and or misconceptions of the American soldier in Vietnam?
I think the major myths are that in some sense, the Vietnam veteran is a misfit because of his experience in Vietnam. And I think that's taken entirely out of context. We must go back to the early 60s. We were going through a cultural revolution. Young people questioned authority. I think, frankly, we probably got a little too much from our World War II generation, and so all of this was starting to generate a lot of questioning of authority, drugs, all of these kinds of things. And I dare say, if we had not had the Vietnam War, we still would have had all of this cultural and social upheaval, because those were the times we lived in. What the Vietnam War did was perhaps aggravate that more, because it became a focal point for protests and for questioning authority. Had we not had that focal point, I think there would have been other things that the generation would have grabbed onto, particularly social injustice with racism and that kind of thing. And the other point would be that a lot of people blame drugs and alcohol and all that kind of thing because of Vietnam. But the war had gone on long enough that when you get into the 68, 69, 70 time frame, you're actually finding people being drafted in the Army and going over there that had already been weaned on drugs and alcohol and anti-war sentiment. It's just they got caught up in the draft. Vietnam did not do that to them. It was the culture of the 60s that made them the protesters and the druggies and all that other stuff. It wasn't Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they got over there, and that stuff was easier to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And then they may find it convenient to blame it on Vietnam, when in fact I think it was just a cultural thing that was happening anyway in the 60s.
Okay.
My opinion.
Yeah. Well, that's what this is about.
Yeah.
How has the government taken care of or not taken care of the Vietnam veterans since the war?
I think the government, by and large, has done a good job. I do fault the government for fighting this Agent Orange thing so long. I think they could have been more forthcoming earlier with the Agent Orange issue.
Mm-hmm.
I have a disability for my loan. It's not a lot of money, I wanted that. I applied for that shortly before I left the Army Reserve,
mm-hmm.
and my only reason was because my leg was getting sore, and I wanted it covered in case in my old age I started getting arthritis or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I did apply for disability, and I have one. It's a small one, 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And they were gracious at that. The PTSD thing, I think, really deserves some real careful scrutiny. I think there are a lot of people that suffer from PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
I also believe there are a lot of others who do not, yet are collecting it, because I think it's become a gravy train for extra income from a generation that, because of lifestyles and everything else, from the 60s, maybe they didn't take care of their bodies as well as they should have, or their personal income or anything else, and now they're looking for income streams to tide them over as they get older.
Mm-hmm.
And this is typical of a government program managed by the government, and it is extremely unfortunate because some people really deserve PTSD monies and help. And yet I know many others who have it, and they just got into the system, knew how to work the system, and eventually collected this income.
Okay.
That may not be a popular view, but it's my view.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Again, this is what this is about. I want you to say exactly what you want to say about these issues. Dave, for the younger generation today, what would you tell them about the Vietnam War? I'm talking high school, college students in America.
I would tell them, and I do because I go to schools to talk quite a bit. I would tell them that these people were very brave. They were in a war where the national aim was uncertain. They were in a war where they didn't get much support from home.
Mm-hmm.
They were in a war that was intensely personal, and virtually everyone was guaranteed to see some combat, whether it was being rocketed in your base camp or up front and personal in a firefight.
Mm-hmm.
All of the data that I've seen shows that the Vietnam soldier was exposed to a lot more combat than those exposed to in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that with honor, considering everything that was thrown at them, lack of support, unsure aims, and the rotation policies and everything else. By and large, they did a hell of a good job.
Okay. Have you been to Washington, D.C. and the Vietnam War Memorial there?
Yes, many times.
Can you tell me about your first trip there, your first experience?
My first trip, the children were small or young,
mm-hmm.
and we went for a trip to Washington to go to the White House and the Capitol building and everything else, the things you could do before 9/11. And we did go to the wall, and I could feel a lot of emotion swelling up inside me, but I just held it. I just checked it. I did not want to let go in front of my small children. And so We looked at it, and then we moved on. I think my wife was a little perplexed that I kind of showed indifference, but I was just trying to manage myself. A year or so after that, I had an occasion on a business trip to go to Washington, and I took that occasion to go back to the wall by myself. And that was when it became a healing point for me, and I could spend time there by myself. And since then now, I mean, I go, the emotion has changed to awe and respect. It's a place that's a catharsis. And so, you know, and I've gone with my kids since they're grown, and with middle school kids that my wife teaches and that kind of thing. And it's amazing to me how children of all ages come to that wall and they suddenly become silent and respectful. It just has that ability to change people.
Why do you think that is the case?
I don't know.
Is it the design? Is it the...
I think it is probably the design. It's just to look at all those names.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, and anybody can identify with it. They can make it very, very personal. Even if a student did not know anyone who was in Vietnam War, they could look at those names and feel drawn to them. They could, I think, in a sense, they could identify with those names. And that makes it very personal for everyone.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you tried to find names of those you knew.
Yeah. For me, it's that the men I lost on the 3rd of June, as well as that helicopter pilot and his crew chief, the guy that I got back to the ditch, he eventually lived. I was never able to locate him. He's a strong fella, and he lived. But those names are within the span of about four lines on one section of the wall. And whenever I look at that, I kind of look for my own name. And it could very easily have been there. So that's the way it was.
What about the moving wall? Have you been to that?
Yes. That came to Ohio a number of years ago, and I went to that. And I think that does a very good job as well.
Okay.
Yeah. I've seen veterans come to that. It's like they were in Washington. Because the names are there, the design is there, the sacrifice is there. So I think it has a lot of meaning for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dave, I wanted to ask you basically about your experience talking about Vietnam and doing this oral history interview with the Oral History Project here at the Vietnam Archive. What has it been for you? Has it been a good experience, or what kind of experience has it been for you?
I think it's been good. It's caused me to reflect and kind of put everything together. It's been a catharsis. I think any time that we want to gather and talk about this is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very appreciative of the opportunity you've taken of your time to spend all this time there, you know, to talk to someone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been good, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Very good. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or discuss that we have not covered?
I don't think so. I think it's we've covered it all. God bless you and your university and everything you folks do, and God bless America.
All right. Thank you very much, Dave. We'll end the oral history interview now with Mr. Dave Taylor.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.